In 2002, while the Bush administration was making its case for invading Iraq, Marcos Melitzis Zuniga started what would become one of the most widely read and influential political blogs in the country, Daily Kos. His new book, Taking on the System, Rules for Radical Change in a Digital Era, suggests ways that the Internet can be used to break down the barriers between the public and the people in power, and how organized online communities can significantly influence the media and the political establishment. It's published by Celebra,
which is a Penguin imprint.
And I'm very pleased that it brings Marcos Melitzis Zuniga to this show today. Hello.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to be in New York City.
Was that what got you going, the build-up to the war? Or was there a specific event that prompted you to start writing a blog?
I was always interested in politics my entire life. But it was the 2000 election that really sort of reactivated me from a passive consumer of news information to somebody who was seeking a lot more information. And technology, by 2002, with blogging technology, allowed me to really jump in and become even more active than before.
The first words you posted were, "I am progressive, I am liberal, I make no apologies." Did that distinguish you from other bloggers at the time?
It might not have distinguished me from other bloggers, but it distinguished me from the broader media landscape. I mean, 2002 was a terrible time to be a liberal or a progressive. It was a sort of the tail end of the Afghanistan invasion, the run-up to the Iraq war, and criticizing the president on any issue was considered to be traitorous and un-American. And I'm an Army vet. I mean, nobody was going to tell me that I could not exercise my free speech rights. And this was my little protest. I mean, at the time, nobody thought it was going to – even the medium itself was ever going to be as influential as it is today. So that was my little protest against that stifling political environment.
You say you're an Army vet. You served in the Gulf War. And you've said that you entered the Army a Republican and left it a Democrat.
You'd be surprised. I mean, first of all, I served during the Gulf War. I actually did not deploy to Iraq, so I don't want any people thinking that I'm exaggerating my life. But it was, when you're in the military, it really is a sort of a collaborative environment where we all look out for each other, and the U.S. government, through the military, took care of our housing and our food and our health care. I mean, it was really almost the idealized, socialized economy. So being in a world where we all looked out for each other and we took care of ourselves, sort of the common good, to go from that back to the United States, George Bush's America, George Bush Sr., where it was about individualism and everybody out for themselves, really rubbed me the wrong way.
Why had you joined the Army in the first place?
It was these quaint notions of service to your country and wanting to be part of something larger. And I also was interested in politics, and I thought maybe someday I might run for office.
Was the fact that you were an immigrant a factor as well? A lot of immigrants wind up serving in the military.
Well, I mean, it helps that when you're an immigrant, and I was from El Salvador, that
You're from El Salvador with a couple of Greek names.
Right. My father was Greek. My mother's from El Salvador. They met going to college in Chicago, actually. And so I joined the Army in large part because it was a good way to pay for school. I mean, my family didn't have the money for me to go to college. But really, that was a secondary consideration for me.
So your parents moved here because they went to school here? How old were you when they immigrated to the United States?
I was actually born in Chicago, but I moved with my family. They moved me. I mean, I was 2 or 3 years old when they moved back to El Salvador. And we stayed there till 1980. I was 9 years old, and there was obviously a brutal civil war at the time, and they fled that. And they went back to Chicago because that's where they knew people.
How aware were you of what was going on?
In El Salvador?
Yes.
Oh, very much.
The repressive government and the civil war.
Yeah, it was a war with no good guys. I mean, it was a very repressive regime, but also a very brutal guerrilla, communist guerrilla force. So, I saw more than any 9-year-old really needs to see in life.
How did you come up with the name of your blog, Daily Kos?
Kos is it's my Army nickname.
From Marcos.
Right, from Marcos. People kept trying to call me Mark, and I said, don't anglicize my name. You can call me anything you want. Just don't call me Mark. And then some smartasses tried to call me Kos, and I said, it's good enough for me. I'll take it.
And you started blogging, as I said, in 2002 at a time when the blogosphere was a lot less crowded. Was that important in establishing yourself?
To a certain degree. I mean, it was still very, very crowded. I mean, when we talk in taking on the system about people being able to take an active role in their politics, I mean, this was what was happening in 2002. The technology was evolving in a way that you did not have to be a passive consumer of news and information anymore. You can actually start taking an active role. And so a lot of people were jumping in. I think what Daily Coast did differently than a lot of blogs is that rather than focus on myself and my writing, I actually heavily focus on the community side of things, enabling other people to also have a say.
Well, you also were finding other people who were like-minded, because there were people all throughout the country, but you point out that the mainstream media weren't asking enough questions about the Bush administration's plan to go to war in Iraq. So when you started posting your doubts and your concerns, did you get immediate feedback? Were you surprised by how much of a feedback you got?
I like to say that there was clearly a market need for strong, unapologetic voices like mine that were really trying to dissect the spin that we were getting from the Bush administration on Iraq and arrive at something more closer to the truth than what the traditional media was providing.
What's been your reaction to later admissions by many people in the media that they weren't skeptical enough at the time?
Well, I mean, it was obvious. Anybody that was paying attention, and I wonder, I actually
Why do you think there wasn't more debate?
I think what happens is that since the traditional media is very heavily concentrated in places like New York City and Washington, D.C., that you get that sort of echo chamber. While people outside of D.C., and this is part of the beauty of this medium, is that we're pretty much all outside. We're all over in the rest of the country, right? You have these pundits out here who like to talk for the heartland and for real Americans. Well, we are the heartland. We are real Americans. And the way we were seeing the spin and the propaganda from the administration really didn't jive with any real common sense.
But, you know, if you listen to many talk shows with call-ins, not in public radio where callers tend to be smarter, you just hear people blowing off steam. And haven't we seen quite a bit of that on the blogs as well?
I actually think that it's good. People want a say. And the outlets for that to happen had been limited in the past. Really, you could call into a show, or that was pretty much it, right? You really, unless you had a show.
You'd sound crazy because you're screaming at the top of your lungs.
Well, and you get 30 seconds to make your point. You don't even get a chance to fully explain the rationale and what leads you to believe a certain way. What you're seeing in new media is this sort of back and forth, and not just in the blogs. People like to focus on the blogs because we're sort of trendy, but also people making videos on YouTube and podcasters, and the rise of ethnic media, I think, is a huge story. Ethnic communities realizing, you know what, we want our own voice represented because the traditional media clearly isn't providing that.
My guest is Marcos Melitzas Zuniga, who is the founder of Daily Coast, and he's written a book called Taking on the System, Rules for Radical Change in a Digital Era. And one example you give to show the influence of Daily Coast and other progressive blogs is with getting James Webb to run against George Allen in Virginia's U.S. Senate race in 2006. How did you influence that race?
Well, you know, we set out early on that cycle. This is the 2006 election cycle. 2005, we were looking for a candidate to take on George Allen. George Allen wasn't just your average Republican. I mean, this is a guy who had won big elections in Virginia, was the front runner for the Republican nomination for president. I mean, this is about as big a Republican as you can get. Had about $15 million in the bank. I mean, it was really a fool's errand. The Democratic Party had written it off.
They've chosen Harris Miller as their candidate.
He was their sacrificial lamb, somebody they felt comfortable with. We set out to find somebody who was going to be a better fit for the state, and we found him in Jim Webb, who was a former naval secretary under Ronald Reagan.
Well, he's a former Republican, in fact.
Former
Jim
Republican.
Webb.
In fact, he had voted for George Allen in 2000. So he was an unlikely person, and he looked at the race and he said, you know, there's no way I can win this, right? I don't have the money. Nobody knows who I am. I'm a former Republican. You know, Democrats aren't going to really accept me in a primary, so I'm going to pass. But we lobbied for him. We did some early fundraising, and a team in Virginia actually started putting together research materials that convinced him that he would have the infrastructure in place to win both the primary and to be competitive in a general election at a time when, keep in mind, he was about 30 to 40 points behind George Allen in early polling.
And then came the Makaka incident, which did a lot to hurt George Allen. That was first circulated on YouTube, not in the mainstream media.
Yeah, you know what's ironic about the Makaka incident, for those who don't know, this is there was an Indian American who was videotaping a George Allen speech for the Democratic Party, and this is a very white southern part of the state, and George Allen started berating him and calling him, there's Makaka in the back. Turns out Makaka is a type of monkey. He was basically calling him monkey. Originally, part of George Allen's rant was "Welcome to real Virginia." Right, and so the Jim Webb campaign took this as sort of North Virginia versus South Virginia, and tried to create sort of a regional tension sort of thing. And we looked at it.
North Virginia being more liberal, closer to Washington,
and more multicultural. And exactly, it's a suburb of Washington D.C. essentially. Well, we looked at this and said, "Who cares about the regional stuff? This is more of a long history of racist behavior on the part of George Allen," and that's sort of the narrative that took hold. I mean, nobody cared about North versus South; it was more of a pattern, and there was a clear pattern. We didn't make this up; it existed, of racist and insensitive things that George Allen had done in his career.
How do you feel about the debate over whether or not bloggers should be viewed as journalists? Aren't they really functioning more as commentators or amateur pundits?
In taking on the system, I really focus on the amateur component, because it used to be that you had to be a so-called professional to do anything, right? You had to get credentialed or get a degree or have somebody bestow a title on you, and then you had the right to talk, and not just about politics, but I'm talking about everything from music to the arts to culture, sports, and so on. So what you have is, you know, suddenly it's this culture of the amateur that's arisen, where technology allows amateurs to do things like discover comets. You know, you have amateur astronomers. To me, the notion of amateur is sort of silly, because an astronomer is somebody who studies the stars, right? If you study the stars, who cares if you have a degree or not? You're an astronaut. But we like to slap on amateur. But what you have is the culture is evolving, that where people are more accepting of amateurs. They're realizing that the so-called experts maybe don't know half the things they're talking about, and amateurs are just as likely or even more informed.
Were you an amateur when you began, or had you had some experience in journalism?
I have a degree in journalism, which I consider to be absolute rubbish, to be perfectly honest. I have a degree in political science. In fact, my entire education, and I have a JD, I have a law degree, I consider to be completely irrelevant to what I know and to what I've accomplished. I mean, I've been able to accomplish this without the proper credentials.
Because in journalism school, they talk a lot about being objective. And you, obviously, and most bloggers who write about politics have very real biases.
There's the objective part, but I did take editorial writing courses, which do allow bias. But there's the inverted pyramid and AP style and all these sort of theories of journalism. And you know, we essentially created a brand new medium that has no rules, and you are judged by the quality of your work, not who you are, what organization you work for.
But generally, the bloggers don't do their own reporting. They simply comment on other people's work.
That's not true, actually. I've done a fair amount of original reporting. In fact, a lot of the revelations about Sarah Palin over the last few days has emerged from Daily Kos, actually, has been picked up by the traditional media. And you have entire blog networks such as a Talking Points Memo, which is Josh Marshall here in New York City, actually, who is predicated on a reporting staff using the blogging medium to report and do the type of muckraking and investigative reporting that has been cut out of a lot of newsrooms because of budget cuts.
And you say, in talking about Joshua Marshall and bloggers like you, that the content of what's being said is more important than who is saying it. How can the public distinguish legitimate websites from those that are not reliable or factual or trustworthy?
That's one of the big challenges, and one thing that we encourage is that you should always be skeptical of everything you read, because everybody has biases. And that's a good thing, because we have not been skeptical of our media, which is why the administration got away with selling a war without any real evidence that Saddam Hussein had any role in 9/11.
When you write for Newsweek, because this led to you getting a column in Newsweek, do you write any differently?
Yes. For every medium that I work in, you have to adjust the way you write. just like writing Taking on a System was a completely different beast, obviously. I mean, 95,000 words compared to my 300-word pithy blog post. When I write for a Newsweek, I can't be – if I'm going to be partisan, I have to support it a certain way that I don't have to at Daily Coast, because I know my audience knows me, they know my background, and they know the backstory of most of the items I write about. So I don't have to sit there and explain background and lay out the full arguments. I can be more pithy and to the point.
In this book, you talk about more than politics, and aside from the growing ability for the online community to influence politics, you also point to examples of how people have been able to challenge what you call the gatekeepers, such as the music industry. Why is the music industry a power that should be challenged right now? Isn't it going through a lot of trouble?
They're going through a lot of trouble precisely because their gatekeeping ways have kept a lot of music that people want out of people's hands. They decided they were going to be the arbiters of taste. And I'm glad you brought this up. I mean, I think it's important to note that these technological changes go far beyond politics and really affect our broader culture. I mean, everything from literature to Hollywood, to video, to the music labels. And anytime you have a gatekeeping elite that's determining what should get published, what should get printed, what should get recorded, it's a bad thing. Let democracy reign. Let the people decide for themselves.
What happened to Fiona Apple's album release in 2005?
Right. It was squashed by the record label. They did not like the material. They said there wasn't anything commercial about it. So pieces got leaked online, and fans decided to distribute it online. They reviewed it online.
And it became a hit.
And it became a big hit.
More recently, Radiohead decided to release its album in rainbows on the internet before CDs went on sale. And they invited people to pay whatever they wanted for it. Did they get a reasonable amount of money from fans?
They refused to divulge exact numbers, but by all indications, they were making more per album sold than they would have royalty rates for CDs. I mean, remember, I mean...
They can get away with it because they're Radiohead. They're not some unknown band.
But there's a lot of new bands that are emerging on places like MySpace who are completely bypassing the record labels and distributing directly to their fans, and without all the overhead and without having to pay off commissions to agents and labels and promoters and so on, they can actually keep a bigger cut of maybe it's a smaller amount of overall money, but they get a bigger cut of it.
What's been the reaction in the music industry?
Well, I think they're scrambling around like chickens with their heads cut off. They don't know what to make of this. I've been reading lately, they're making deals with MySpace and trying to tap into that social networking stuff. And they're definitely using the social networks as a recruiting tool. They're seeing who gets popular, who attracts a crowd, and then they're going to go out and give those people record labels, much, I think, as this book itself was treated by Penguin. I mean, they saw I had gathered a fairly large readership online, and they used that to their advantage in giving me this book deal.
And I'm talking to Marcos Melitzas Zuniga, the founder of Daily Kos. His book, this second book, Taking on the System, Rules for Radical Change in a Digital Era, published by Celebra, which is a division of Penguin. I saw a film just the other day that has yet to be released called Boogeyman, about Lee Atwater, and a man who, I guess the boogie was a pun because he also was a musician, a guitar player. But he made the point that reality is a matter of perception, and as a result, Republicans have been setting the terms for the political debate for many years, often putting Democrats on the defensive and controlling the language used to frame the issues, calling the estate tax the death tax as an example. Has there been a reversal at all with political bloggers now?
Well, one of the things that bloggers knew instinctively, and again, not just bloggers, but people who are really part of this digital movement, people-powered media, is that stories work, right? And Republicans are very good at telling stories. I mean, the welfare mom, right? It's a perfect example of that. Stories work. So while Democrats traditionally, they want to throw up flowcharts and pie graphs and Excel spreadsheets, trying to explain why Democratic policies are better for the average American, we realized that was not really playing very well where we lived, which was outside of Washington, D.C. and New York City. And so we started telling stories. And it's actually an entire chapter in my book, how important it is to tell stories. And the Makaka incident was a perfect example. Rather than focus on sort of the legislation that George Allen voted for, we focus on who he was as a person, and we painted a story of him as this basically this bigoted, racist individual.
The people like Rush Limbaugh were credited with influencing political races. Do you think that the now that these liberal bloggers are having the same impact, or Move On, for example, the now I've suddenly forgotten her name, isn't that terrible? The Huffington Report.
Oh yeah, Arianna Huffington. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you can't look further. You don't have to look further than Jim Webb, which I obviously write a lot about in the book. But also people like
Webb was on the web, so.
But
what do you expect?
But people like John Tester, yeah, exactly. People like John Tester in Montana, and we targeted these races on purpose because they were red states, supposedly unwinnable against entrenched incumbents. I mean, we wanted to make a point that we could win these races if we contested them at a time when the Democratic establishment really only wanted to run races in places like Rhode Island and New York and Democratic strongholds.
Still, Matt Drudge continues to have an awful lot of clout.
Huge.
So I guess the clout cuts both ways, doesn't it?
Well, they've had that advantage on the right for a long time, from Matt Drudge to Rush Limbaugh to Fox News and Sean Hannity and Bill O'Reilly and that crowd. We really haven't had any of that. As much as conservatives like to cry about the liberal media, there is no partisan liberal media. There was none. Now we're on the scene, and we're still a smidgen. We're a speck compared to what they have, but at least we have the seeds of a truly liberal media, and we're working to build it and get stronger.
Are online political communities growing outside of the United States in the same way that they are here?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, in a lot of countries, they're even more influential and more ingrained in public life, as in, for example, Korea, where an entire presidency essentially was created online. So it's definitely something that it's not – it looks culturally. It may look different country to country, but the use of new technologies in order to engage regular and average people in their world around them is really it's a global phenomenon.
But it does require access to personal computers and the internet, and that would leave out much of the developing world, wouldn't it?
You'd think so, but actually that's not really true. One of the examples I talk about in taking on the system are the immigration protests that happened a couple of years ago all across the country, this country. Huge. They were organized by ethnic media and, believe it or not, cell phones, text messaging, because cell phones had the greatest penetration in Latin American and Latino communities, second greatest penetration in African American communities. Now, these are communities that have less internet access, but they can still use ethnic media, and they can use cell phones to organize and to come together. And I also talk in the book about the Ukraine, where maybe 1% of the people have internet access, yet they were able to use cell phones and that 1% of internet-connected people to organize the Orange Revolution a couple of years ago. So this is not so much about the internet. It's about using new technologies and new media to communicate and organize.
One of your suggestions is to embrace the attacks against you. Are bloggers more vulnerable to criticism?
Well, nobody respects bloggers because we don't have institutional credibility. We don't work for the New York Times. We don't work for the New Republic. So if we screw up, you know, this is it. This is our credibility. So our credibility is on the line every time we write something, every single day, and we have to guard that credibility at all costs.
You write about the biggest backlash against Daily Kos in 2004 after you wrote a post in response to the Blackwater contractors who were killed and strung up on a bridge in Fallujah. What did you write?
Well, it was early morning, and I was angry. Remember, I'm a U.S. Army vet. The same day that those four Fallujah mercenaries were killed, five U.S. Army engineers were also killed near Fallujah. Yet the news were so focused on these contractors, these mercenaries, and completely ignoring my fellow brothers and sisters in arms, you know, people who wore combat boots like I did in service to our nation, not to Blackwater Corporation. So I was angry. So I said, "Screw them! This is not a video game. Let people see what war really looks like." And, of course, the right wing went ballistic, and this was the first time I was really in the firing line, you know, where I was actually getting bombarded by sort of these attacks. And I realized after a couple of days of this that really it did not affect me in any way, but my traffic was up. I was getting calls from reporters. They had actually helped build my credibility. And this
so
is
some, all press is good press?
It really turns out. I mean, that's actually – I mean, it's an old and worn sort of metaphor, but it's true. And I think liberals make this mistake with Ann Coulter, you know, among others. They give her credibility by continuously attacking her when ignoring her would make her go away.
If Barack Obama wins the presidential election, will you have as much to write about?
Believe me, we'll probably have more. One of the guiding principles and founding principles of Daily Kos and a lot of blogs like it is that we want more Democrats, sure, but we want better Democrats. And there are still a lot of Democrats in D.C. who are corrupt, who are beholden to corporate interests, who have forgotten who they serve. So our job is going to be to keep our party honest, because we're not going to be like Republicans who let George Bush pillage our country for 8 years without saying anything. We're going to hold our party accountable. We're going to hold Barack Obama accountable.
Marcos will be speaking at the Barnes & Noble store tonight in Brooklyn. That's
tomorrow night, Thursday.
Okay, tomorrow night, 106 Court Street at 7 o'clock, and signing books. You can join him there and then go watch the Republican convention and have a drink in Chinatown at Drinking Liberally. Details are on our show page. His book is Taking on the System, Rules for Radical Change in a Digital Era. And my great thanks to Marcos Melitzis-Zuniga for being our guest today.
Pleasure, anytime.